Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. We have a very active agenda today, so we're trying to keep it moving. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2541. Senator Kubley, welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2541 just deals with an issue of vehicle exemptions for tribal governments. If there is an amendment in your packet, Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could do that first or...
Passing it out. An A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned, this just deals with some ways of vehicle registration, for tribal governments. And Chair Kevin Genfold from Upper Sioux is with me today, and if it's okay, Mr. Chair, we'll bring him to the table and let him visit with you about the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Kevin Genfold. I am the tribal chairman for the Upper Sioux community, which is located approximately 120 miles west of the metropolitan area. In regards to what brings me here today is...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, is this microphone on?
Yes.
Okay. We can hear you.
I apologize that I do have a cold today, so I'll do the best I can to speak as loud as I can. Our tribe there, we utilize the state. We have tax-exempt plates on all of our government vehicles. Recently, we developed a police department as well as an office of the environment in the last 5 years. And in doing so, we've acquired additional equipment for our tribes to utilize for our tribal nation. Some of those are snowmobiles, two ATVs, a Polaris Ranger, as well as a flat-bottom boat. In doing so, we've encountered difficulties with the registration that they need to be registered as recreational vehicles. It's our tribal position that they are government vehicles, and they are used strictly for governmental purposes, and that... we do have several MOUs with surrounding counties and local governments, different firefighting agencies, different ambulance services, and the surrounding towns. It is our position that they are used strictly for those purposes, and we would request consideration that they be viewed as government vehicles and be given the exempt status. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is this bill supported by all the tribes and bands?
I wouldn't know the answer to that question, Mr. Chairman. I come strictly on behalf of the Upper Sioux people.
Okay. Do you not have comment on cost? Is it minimal? How many vehicles are we potentially talking? Mr. Meyer?
Uh,
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Myers, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I do not have a fiscal impact on this, but we'll certainly get that for you right away. I did meet with Greg Knopf previous to this on the watercraft piece. I think we're going to have to do an amendment because we need to petition to Homeland Security to actually get those exempted. Otherwise, we'll have some issues with them, so we'll try to figure that out, and if we need to amend the bill as it moves forward, deal with it in that way.
So we'll send it to Finance just to double-check the cost, Senator Quigley.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
We'll send it to Finance just to double-check on the cost.
Yes, that'd be fine, Mr. Chair.
We can figure out how many vehicles we're talking about. Okay, discussion. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question here. Senator Quigley, as you know, we run into a little bit of a loggerhead on the floor not too long ago today with regards to tribal government versus state, other political subdivisions here in the state, it being very different in that they're a sovereign nation. I guess I have to reiterate the question that the chair had. Have you talked with the rest of the tribal nations throughout the state of Minnesota, and how are they being treated? Maybe the DNR can answer that. I'm not sure.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, you know, the amendment comes from the Leech Lake Band, so I assume the bill was all right with them. So, you know, they're really the only ones that other tribes that I've had a contact with on this bill.
I'm presuming, unless they come forward and say they object to this, I presume they are in favor of not paying the registration fee whenever possible. So I'm presuming support, but this isn't the final stop. Senator Dibble.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I'm glad this is going to Finance, and I look forward to seeing the fiscal note. I'm wondering if we know offhand, is there an impact to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, the Trunk Highway Fund, particularly with respect to motorcycles? And we don't have to answer that question now, but I'll be especially interested in that, and we'll have a chance to maybe see that in transportation.
Mr. Chairman, Finance. Senator Dibble, it will not affect it. This only affects those that are registered as an off-highway motorcycle. It doesn't affect a road motorcycle registration. This is strictly a DNR registration.
I'll look forward to not seeing it in transportation.
Yeah, I can't imagine we're talking about a ton of vehicles here. It's just kind of, I think it just kind of clarifies that they are part of the approach we take to other government entities in the state in regards to registration. Further discussion? Senator Dibble, would you move the bill? Senator Dibble will move that Senate File 2541, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Senate File 445. I'm sorry we haven't heard this prior to now. You introduced this fairly early last session.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and it's appropriate that it's Canada Day on the Hill. The resolution that you have before you, Senate File 445, really asks the Lake of the Woods Water Sustainable Foundation would like to have this resolution sent to the International Joint Commission, which is really the organization that kind of controls the relationships between Canada and the northern tier states. And on that joint commission sit a number of congressmen and members of parliament, and so they are the kind of the entity that really controls a lot of the things that happen between the United States and the Canadian counterpart. So Lake of the Woods is a very important body of water for us. It's the largest inland lake. It has multiple sources of it's multiple sources of tourism, fisheries, clean water, hydro water, hydroelectric that's generated. So it's a very, very important body of water for the whole big Midwest region. And what we're asking for is that we would like to see this joint commission take a look at the quality of that water. And it has been deteriorating. I know a bill that I had carried maybe 20 years ago or so was for a smaller community to clean up the wastewater that was basically going directly into the ditch and then the ditch into the lake. And so I think some of those things have, over time, had its impact on the quality of the water in Lake of the Woods. And I do have Mr. Moore here who would like to say a comment or two.
I think if there are any specific questions, maybe Mr. Moore, if you could take them. This is pretty straightforward. Committee members, discussion, questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, who sits on the International Joint Commission? How are those members appointed?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Vic Moore, and I represent Lake of the Woods Water Sustainable Foundation. I believe that the commission was set up 100 years ago, and I believe its members are appointed by Congress and by the Parliament in Canada.
Not seeing any other hands. If not, Senator Stump moved that Senate File 445 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Rules. That's where they want our resolutions to go.
Okay. I make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Next item on the agenda is Senate File 2484. Senator Olson.
Want me to look in the hall?
Yeah. Maybe we could take 2780 first.
There she is.
Okay, yep. Come on in.
It's a great support.
Let's take Senate File 2780 first. He's right behind you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just very briefly, this is a bill that for a resolution that mirrors a resolution that was passed by Explore Minnesota Tourism Council. And I will, with that, turn it over to Mr. Newstrom with the Minnesota Congress of Resorts to give you a brief background.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Tom Newstrom. I'm a professional guide from Grand Rapids, Minnesota for the past 31 years.
Proceed.
We've come across a problem here that we hope will get rectified in the future. We have never been mandated by the federal government for any kind of licensing procedures within the inland waters of Minnesota. This entire procedure really affects about 500 to 700 guides, and it's over $1 billion business with the resorts and all the different guide entities within the state. We carry insurance. The majority of us carry the proper insurance. We also understand that there's some licensing procedures that we hopefully the state will be involved in the future. And we also feel that the data that we could provide to the state as a guide group, a state guide group, would be insurmountable. And we also feel that we're small boat guides, Mr. Chairman. We operate 16 to 20 foot boats. We don't go up against barges and ships and submarines. We go up against real people operating smaller boats. And I really stand to challenge anyone to say that a guide has been involved in an accident in the 31 years that I've been a professional guide. I think we're all responsible. And it would be a great hardship on most of the guides if they had to go through some huge monetary process when a lot of them aren't full-time guides, but they're part-time guides. But the resort industry really, really relies on their expertise.
Sarah Olson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to kind of give a brief overview of what led to this, the Coast Guard has recently talked about requiring not only our fishing guides, but even dock boys, anybody who actually got into certain waters on a boat, to have to go through a very elaborate and very expensive licensing process that usually really applies to waters like Lake Superior, ocean-going vessels. And so, actually, I just heard from the DNR just before this meeting that they are in the process of working through Congressman Oberstar's office and believe that they are going to be able to come to some kind of an accord to work this out, but this resolution will help to support that process. And if you'd like any further background or details, Mr. Edmond from Explore Minnesota is also here with me.
Mr. Edmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. And I just want to thank you very much for taking up this this resolution. It was brought to the attention of the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council by not only fishermen, but resorts and our industry all throughout Minnesota. This was an oversight on the federal government's part. It was not intended to regulate a lot of the small vessels that are operating throughout Minnesota's inland lakes. A lot of these people are helping travelers and visitors come to fish in Minnesota, and this is an unnecessary burden that's being put upon guides throughout the state of Minnesota. So the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, representing all aspects of the tourism industry in Minnesota, from hotels to convention visitors bureaus and chambers of commerce, all came together on this issue and really appreciate not only this legislature taking up this resolution, but feel it needs to be addressed on a federal level. So thank you very much for taking up this matter.
Mr. Newstrom, you affected by these rules too as a guide?
Yes, Senator.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you need to learn as a result of this that ostensibly do not pertain to your work?
Well, in regards to, you mean the things that would really help us to, become more efficient and licensed in a procedure maybe by the state? I'm sorry. I gotcha. You would have to get a TWIC card, which is a transportation workers card. You would have to take a drug and alcohol test and have it sent to Florida to have it analyzed and brought back. Each thing is a cost, a tremendous cost. The class would be a 56-hour class that would cost anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500. It would take a lot of the guys away from their homes, their jobs, in order to do that, because a lot of them work on a different job in the wintertime. The whole cost of it would be anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000, which if you're a part-time guide, say you do 10 to 20 trips for resorts and other people, it would cost you a great amount of money and hardship. And I think in the economic times we're at right now, I think it would be really hard on a lot of the guides to get this done.
Is it true that one of the questions on the test is pertains to how to recognize submarine lights?
Yes.
There are similar questions that you can...
Yes, sir. There are similar questions in regards to large shipping channels, barges, boats of 60 to 200 feet, and we feel that this is not applicable to what we do on a daily basis.
And this is presumably under the guise of Homeland Security.
I assume so.
But we don't know for sure.
No, we're not positive. And then the TWIC card, of course, has to do with the, they're looking at that's for ships and vessels when they come to port to find different people on board. Where, when you're up on Winnie and Leech and the inland lakes that we guide on, we really don't deal with large vessels.
Well, Senator Olson, I think that your resolution is mild. I would think that just from my own point of view, you would at least have one be it resolved paragraph that talks about a first preference being just to repeal the six-pack rules as it applies to small vessels on inland lakes and rivers. Mr. Newstrom, Mr. Edmund, is that something you'd be amenable to if we were to develop similar language? Language along those lines?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think these language, these Coast Guard regulations have been on the books for a long period of time, and that there's some reasons for it from a national perspective, but it was not meant for the small inland vessels that affect the livelihoods of the fishing guides all throughout the state of Minnesota. And so I think what we were urging is not necessarily a repeal of the regulations, but flexibility in enforcing it. It has not been enforced for many, many years, and for a reason, because it doesn't apply. Now, for some reason, we don't know why, they have started to enforce it, and we think that presents a tremendous hardship, and something needs to be done in regard to that on a federal level.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair.
We don't have to do it. Think about it now, but maybe as it comes to the floor, we could do a floor amendment that says, as it pertains to just these inland lakes and river vessels, 16 to 20 foot outboard boats. Outboard boats.
Mr. Chair, if you wanted any more information about the state of the negotiations, I guess you could say, between the DNR and what's happening at the federal level, I'm sure we could have someone from the DNR speak to that. But I think they still would say that they're supportive of the resolution going ahead as it stands. And it may very well be that just what you're suggested will be the end result, is that there will be some of these lakes excluded from federal regulation. But I'd rather hear from the DNR if you want to go into that now.
Well, we can talk about it later. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer an amendment and to make the resolve clause a little more direct. Mm-hmm. I move on line 1, page 1, line 15, delete by and insert that. After Minnesota, insert requests and delete should. So it would be resolved that the legislature of the state of Minnesota requests that Congress speedily enact legislation.
Okay. Seeing Senator Olson agrees with that, everyone understand that amendment by Senator Fredrickson? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Senate File 2780 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, on behalf of the Guides of Minnesota, I thank you for giving me this time to bring these issues to you and have a better understanding. Thank you.
If there's anything more that we can do on this, aside from a resolution, please let us know. I think Senator Olson has proposed what the legislature can do in this regard. But if there's anything more that we can do, please let us know.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Hey, next item on the agenda, Senate File 2484. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senate File 2484 is a bill that would allow the Lake of Cass Lake. Cass Lake is a lake, and it's also the name of a small community just adjacent to the lake that's located within the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, just south of Bemidji, if any of you are not familiar with it. But it's a fairly large, one of Minnesota's larger lakes. And some years ago, there was a decision made to disallow spearfishing in Cass Lake. This was going to be done on an experimental basis, and the period of time that the experiment was to take place has apparently passed. and the business community in Cass Lake, resorts around the Cass Lake area, a number of people who are interested in spearing and do this as a winter source of a hobby and also for the purpose of smoking and eating Northerns, would all like to see that ban lifted because they're not aware of any good reason to continue the ban in terms of a scientific basis or need for this. The other lakes in the surrounding community, Leech Lake, Winnebagoche, Bemidji, Plantagenet, other larger lakes around the area all allow for spear fishing of Northerns in the same circumstances that Cass Lake would like to have that privilege restored there. And as you know, Mr. Chair, because you and I visited one of the spear an angling house on Cass Lake and talked to some of the residents, this is a very large issue of concern for people in the Cass Lake area. A petition was circulated among the businesses, and to the best of my knowledge, all of the businesses that were contacted supported the removal of this ban. There was a request in the local newspaper for people to weigh in terms of how they felt about the issue, and I guess it was like 5-1 preferred that the ban be lifted. But as we know, at the state level, it isn't just about what the local citizens want. We have to make decisions based on what's best for the lake as well, and it's up to the state legislature to decide. But I would like to also say that when I first heard about this issue, you and I think both asked, what does the DNR say about this? And the mayor of Cass Lake, Mr. LeDuc, who's here with me today, actually wrote a letter to the mayor to the DNR dated January 22nd, explaining that the community would like to have the ban lifted and asking for information as to why Cass Lake has been singled out for being closed to spearing when other areas in the lake, other lakes in the area are not. I followed this with a letter of my own basically saying the same thing. You know, if there's a basis for this, the community hasn't heard it. They've been asking for months, what's the rationale for this? And the only response that was given was apparently I'm repeating this secondhand, but was that, you know, that there was a particular group, Muskies Inc., that was likely to be concerned about this. And so that was the reason why, because it was controversial. They were never given a reason in terms of anything that would be science-based. And so I introduced the bill so that we could try to bring this issue forward and bring it to a head in terms of whether there is science and a reason to really kind of single out this community and single out the businesses and the people who would really like to see the spearing restored and provide a really good rationale for why that's necessary, that Cass Lake should be treated differently than all the other surrounding lakes.
First witness, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm Wayne LeDuc, the mayor of City of Cass Lake. I thank you for your time, and I'll make it brief. I get a tendency to run away when I start speaking, and I know that's true of any politician. You give them around the time, they're going to abuse it, okay? But I'll address it from the city standpoint as far as economics. The City of Cass Lake is a population of 813 people. It is situated on a Leech Lake Indian Reservation. The unemployment rate in the community is about 14-16%. The average median income in the City of Cass Lake is $20,000 or less. We have a tax base of 28%. And it's very difficult to deliver services with a 28% tax base, whereas other communities, larger communities, have a much larger tax base. And we have to provide basically the same services with a much lower tax base than other communities. We would like to see the ban lifted as far as what it would do to promote the local economy, not just seasonal. In the summertime, we do well because the tourists come in. In the wintertime, we're having problems. We're struggling just like every other community up in rural Minnesota, northern Minnesota. And the ban was passed in 1988. It was supposed to be for 10 years, and then it never expired. It was passed permanently by the DNR in 1988. So we've been living with the spearing ban since 1988. I know it's a controversial issue. The city of Cass Lake has the same concerns as Muskie's Inc. We want to promote the economy, but we also want to preserve the natural resources in the area, too. The city of Cass Lake, the Lake of Cass Lake, for most of you probably already know, it's the only place in the United States that has a lake within a lake on Star Island, okay? Lake Windigo. I don't think that spearing on Cass Lake would be detrimental to the Muskie's population on Cass Lake, okay? It was allowed many times before when I was a kid growing up in Cass Lake. It was not uncommon to see a Muskie and a trophy downtown. And it was not detrimental. We had many guides that promoted Muskie fishing, okay? And that was their income. And I can only speak about the economic impact it has on the city of Cass Lake, or will have on the city of Cass Lake. It affects not only the city of Cass Lake, Lease Lake Band of Ojibwe, Pike Bay Township. We have to sit down and take a look at how we do business. We have to change how we do business. We have to look at what we can do to promote the economy in a greater Cass Lake area. And that's the purpose of the bill, okay? It provides some avenue for tourists in the wintertime to come up and enjoy the winter months in a greater Cass Lake area, not just summer. And I thank the committee for your time. I appreciate your time. I know you've got a busy schedule at the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Donald L. Ellis. I'm a lifelong Cass Laker. I was born in Cass Lake. I'm a businessman, and I was there when it happened, right from the get-go to, you know, right from the start to the end. And there was arguments before that you can't, if you ban, put a ban on Cass Lake, it's going to kill Cass Lake on tourism. And it did. My dad had Leroy's Minnows, which was very popular right at the junction of 371 and 2. And before the ban, we were up 5:30 till 10 o'clock helping people with sucker minnows and tackle and everything, all the way from southwestern Minnesota, all across the western border, Ada, all the way up Thief River Falls. And we were, and that part there, the people came to us and bought bait from us. Also, Whispering Pines, which is a motel, was completely full during the wintertime. Completely full. The spears, when they come there, they spent money at our shop, Leroy's Minnows. They stayed at the motels. They ate in every restaurant that was in there, and they went to the bars and they drank a few beers at the bars. They went to the liquor store, bought beers there. They spent money in every spot in our town, and that kept us going through the winter. When that ban went on, I said that when I was at the meetings, and I said when that ban goes on, Cass Lake is going to turn to a ghost town, and it did. I'll say this: we were promised or said that we were going to be there was that much money or more was going to be spent in Cass Lake if it went into effect. Never happened. Cass Lake is still a ghost town. This issue that we're talking about is about muskies. This whole issue is about muskies, not about northern pike. So when we're thinking, we got to think about what this issue is about. The accident, you know, they don't want the preservation of a muskie, but also the rights of the people that have been doing this for their whole lifetime, through families, through their whole generations. And when this happened, there's a generation gap. The 10-year survey. Now there's a 10-year survey of a generation gap where people, young kids, well, they're not going to. They don't get to spear. Their dad quit spearing on that lake, or uncle, so they didn't get to spear on the lake. So there's a generation gap. So that would be a loss in revenue as far as if there's a statistics about how many spear licenses were sold. It's going to drop because it was stopped. in the beginning, we pleaded and just talked to Muskie Inc. They wouldn't hear us. We went to the DNR, pleaded with the DNR. They wouldn't hear us. And I'm glad for this opportunity for you to hear us.
Terrelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I wasn't there at the time, and as I said, until just like a few seconds outside this committee room, it's the first time that I've gotten any kind of a response from the DNR. I think they're neutral on this, but I could they'll speak for themselves in terms of the fishery. I think there are fishery people who are here. But it seems to me that, if I understand the history correctly, 20-some years ago, there was an experiment conducted to see whether this was going to increase the population or the size of muskies, and so there was a ban put on this lake. But there hasn't been any... I read the papers locally, and the predictions are the next trophy muskie fish is going to come out of Lake Bemidji, I think was the prediction I read. There doesn't seem to be a disparity between the fish on this lake and the fish in surrounding lakes that I've heard from the DNR. And so it seems to me like all the emails I've been getting from the Muskie Inc. people are really more directed to the issue of should we spear or shouldn't we spear? Should we not allow spearing because there might be a concern that somehow someone isn't going to know what they're doing and accidentally spear a muskie, or you know, or should we allow something that's been a traditional part of our heritage and say that there really isn't the science, if there isn't, to support continuing this ban and allow Cass Lake to go back and be treated like every other lake in the area is treated? I think that's the issue.
Mr. Ballou?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, the gentleman from Leroy's Minnow, is it Donnie Ellis?
Yes.
Just one question. How is bait used for spearing?
They use suckers, anywhere from maybe 6 inches to maybe 12 inches. Some like them bigger. And they're put on a harness or a pin. Like a harness is just like a piece of plastic-coated leader with a deal on it and a weight on the bottom, and they'll slide that snap down over. It's kind of like friction, and it'll hold the sucker in place, and the sucker will swim around, and it'll use that. It'd be no different than putting a hook through it, only it's used without a hook for bait.
So live and artificial bait are used.
And they use spinners. They would have, like, they call it teaser. It's like an electric, they used to have, way back when, they used to have phonographs, the old phonograph, wind-up phonographs, and you made them out, and you could set the time to set the rotation of it, so you could set the speed of your lure, and you'd have a daredevil down there or something with some spinners on it, and they would spin around.
Interesting.
But that's how you would, or decoys where you're on a string and you'd give them a little flip and they go around. But suckers, live bait was used that way.
All right, Mr. Ballou.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please correct me on the pronunciation if I was not correct.
Ballou is correct.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Steve Ballou from Breaking the Lake Resort on Cass Lake. I am also the Chamber of Commerce President of Cass Lake, and I am co-chair of Cliff's organization, which is Cass Lake Initiative for Spearing. We've seen a loss in revenue just at the resort level and my fellow resorters on the lake that are open during the wintertime. We are getting phone calls asking for an angling house along with a spearing house on the same lake and would like to stay at my resort. I could not offer them that because we do not spear on Cass Lake. So in turn, they went elsewhere for their business. That was a loss of revenue, I feel, for me and my business at my resort. I'm sure all of you have known that the tourism business has been going down steadily in the last few years, and anything that we can find to help us out at any time is a plus for us. Wintertime activities, I do have ice houses that are for rent for angle fishing, but the phone calls that I did receive also wanted spear fishing, which we didn't have. I had to turn those customers away. My fellow chamber members that are on the Chamber of Commerce with me, the majority of them are also in favor of this. The chamber in the early stages took a stand to remain neutral They represent 118 members in the whole community, not just the city of Cass Lake or Cass Lake itself. They have members from Bemidji also. So they took a neutral stand. They're not against it. They're not for it. They want the betterment for the community. They're looking for economic development for the community to grow. We also had local support. We've been holding meetings with our Cliffs organization monthly. We went around and 100% of the local businesses that we contacted, and I believe our count is up to 47 at this time, we have notarized signatures of those businesses that are all for lifting the ban in Cass Lake. It's one of the times in Cass Lake that's historic for me that I've seen a community get together, and this is not just one individual or one group. This is the whole community of Cass Lake that wants to see this changed. Just for an instance, what we had done is did a little bit of a survey. One quick note. Again, Cass Lake is closed to spearing. Out of the Muskie Inc. magazine that just came out last month, they have posted their 50-inch plus muskies that they've caught. Now, again, Cass Lake's closed to spearing, so we should have some huge muskies coming out of Cass Lake and many numbers. Big Lake, which is closed to spearing, they had 3 over 50 inches. Cass Lake had 5 over 50 inches last year. Bemidji had 12, which is open to spearing. Plantagenet had 9, which is open to spearing. And Leech Lake had 7, which is also open to spearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do all of those lakes stock muskies?
That I'm not aware of. I can't answer that one for you.
Okay. Senator Olson.
And the only thing I would say also, Mr. Chair, is that both Plantagenet and Bemidji are significantly smaller lakes than Cass Lake. Cass Lake is much larger. Even though the smaller lakes where spearing is allowed apparently are producing a greater quantity of larger muskies.
All right. Mr. Phillips?
Yes. Mr. Chair?
Dean Phillips on the... I'm going to take the... Mr. Spreck, I'm going to take the... okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Dean Phillips will not testify today.
Okay, you're going to talk on... All right, great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Tim Spreck. I'm the president of the Minnesota Dark House Angling Association. I also sit on the board of directors for MOHA. We've heard some pretty interesting, compelling testimony by locals today. There really is an overwhelming groundswell of support for this ban in the Cass Lake area, as you have all heard. My job today is to talk more about the science and the basis for the original spearing ban. We all know that Cass Lake was placed under a 10-year spearing ban in 1988 for evaluation. In 1998, the DNR report showed no change in pike population, but they showed a positive change in muskie population. DNR employees questioned the study. They were not given access to the data for their own analysis. One critical employee lost his job as a result of this study. Nobody who conducted the study was willing to sign it, and today the study has never been signed. The Leech Lake Band issued a letter critical of the study and its data. Regardless, Cass Lake was closed permanently to spearing after this evaluation period had passed. All future spearing bans on all lakes are based on this study and the Cass Lake as a test. So we have 26 lakes that are also closed to spearing as a direct result of what happened on Cass Lake. Let's take a look at the study itself. Substituting for scientific data, we have the following. An angler diary of a known anti-spearing muskie supporter is used to show the increase in the size of muskies that he had caught over a period of time during the evaluation period. Secondly, fall electrofishing data is used, even though there is no pre-ban data for comparison. Thirdly, spring netting data is used, even though there is no pre-ban data for comparison. DNR employees tell us off the record that when desired results were not obtained, the dip nets were placed in spawning beds in order to incorporate large spawning females, and skew the data. Taxidermist surveys were used, which means you go to a taxidermist and say, are you mounting any muskies? And they say, yes, and here's the size. None of these taxidermists were ever revealed. We don't know who they are. We don't know if the fish came, in fact, from casts. And, in fact, we don't even know if these taxidermists exist. It's also important to remember, in light of the fact that the study has a considerable cloud of doubt, is the following. If there was an actual increase in size, could it not be accounted for by any of these following items? Originally, smaller Chupac muskie were stocked in casts. Later, the Mississippi strain was stocked. These are considerably larger. This can have an effect on data. Catch and release increases over the time of the evaluation period in the study, which could also allow for additional musky growth. And also remember that post-ban size of northern pike has not changed. So what we're seeing is a penalty for spear fishermen under the auspices of creating a larger size structure for muskies, and what you're getting is neither larger muskies nor larger northern pike. The science does not support a ban. The local economy is overwhelmingly in favor of removing this ban. These people need it up there, but that's not the only reason to take it off. Spear fishermen are not interested in muskies. We target northern pike and rough fish. We know the difference. We're very careful about what we do. Our organization preaches look and release. We talk about concepts like taking mid-size eaters, letting larger trophies swim away. The education is there. The future is good. And there's no reason to penalize not only a local community, but also a group of responsible sportsmen. One other thing to consider. Spear fishermen only take 11% of fish over 20 inches. We're not out there taking a lot of pike. But as a gentleman pointed out earlier, this is not about northern pike. It's about muskies. We're careful. We're responsible. Science doesn't support a ban. Let's help these local people out. Let's help this segment of the sporting population out that needs an opportunity to spread their dollars around the state. Let's do the right thing. Let's take this ban off and let these people enjoy another opportunity to angle in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Olson.
I was just handed a note and asked to point out that Leech Lake band members do have the right to spear on Cass Lake. And they've been in communication with this community of Cass Lake. I don't have a letter from them specifically, but I think their position, Mayor LaDuke, was that they were neutral on this. So, you know, they're leaving it to the community and the legislature, I guess, to make this decision. But I think their feeling was that they had no objection to anyone else having the same right that they do. Yes, and you're a band member as well.
Were you speaking for Mr. Geschel as well, Mr. Sprecher?
Yeah, Roger was not able to make it today, so he will not be testifying.
Anyone else want to testify in favor of the bill?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just so you know and the committee knows, I am an enrolled band member.
Go ahead.
Just so you know, are aware, and the committee is aware, I'm an enrolled band member.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Representative Purcell, do you want to say anything?
Mr. Chair, I put him on the witness list because if he could be here, he's actually a biologist who works for the Leech Lake Band, who I know plan to testify in support of the bill, but I don't see him here.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm kind of wondering about, is this micromanaging a little bit of the DNR? My understanding that the bans on several of these lakes were part of a broader study, not just with Leech Lake, but with other musky lakes, and some were allowed to be speared and some were not. I wish you could address that, or maybe the DNR could.
Senator Kielash, we'll have the DNR come up and talk about it. I think one of the impetuses for Senator Olson's bill was that she was not getting a response from the DNR either way on what the situation, the current situation is with regards to this issue. Okay. Mr. Kelly?
Got some handouts for the committee?
We'll pass those out.
Thank you for giving me some time to speak, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I am Sean Kellett. I'm with Muskies Incorporated and the MMA. I'd like to first point out, we are sympathetic to the cause of the Chamber of Commerce and the economy up in Cass Lake. I know I go up there a few times a year, and every time I do, it's I don't know about what they're saying. My wife will attest here today that I spend a lot of money up in the area. I kind of want to start off today with one of the gentlemen said that he spoke with the Muskies Inc. groups about getting this ban lifted. As far as I know, as far as anyone who I've talked to, there has been no communication about this to anyone. In fact, we were kind of blindsided by this a few weeks ago. If you look at the handouts that are getting passed around, the first one, it's this right here, is a long-range Isosin management plan that was drafted by in conjunction with a lot of different groups. Muskies Incorporated, Northern Zinc, the Dark House Association, and the DNR. And what this basically did is that this laid out a 20-year management plan and process for how the state is going to look at managing all Isosins, Northern Pikes and Muskies, and their interrelationships with each other. Does everyone have a copy of this?
Being passed out.
So far, okay. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here. And what I did is I only took a few pages out of this. The entire plan is almost 100 pages long. Senator, did you receive the email with this attachment?
Yes.
This morning? Okay, good. If anyone wants to dig into it deeper, I made that available. I just didn't want to cut down too many trees today if I could help it. Again, I just highlighted the items that are all. Actually, I don't know if you guys have that. But if you look on page 2, when it looks at the long-range plan goals for Northern Pike, because this interrelationship between Muskies and Northern Pike is a lot more than a lot of these people realize who aren't up to speed with what the DNR has been doing. And in these Northern Pike long-range goals is to provide a high-quality angling opportunities for large Northern Pike and to provide spearing opportunities for Northern Pike. I don't know if you guys know this, but the lakes adjoining Cass Lake, Kitchee, Andrusia, and Pike Bay, are all open to dark house angling right now. So there is opportunity in the area already. If you go to the next page, page 3 of 87, if you look at the participants, while the participants did not reach consensus agreement on some of the specific elements of the plan, there's a list of the names of the people there. When we put this plan together, no one really came out of it with everything they wanted. But one of the things that that we did agree on is that the Muskie crowd would not be looking to add any additional spearing bans. We know that is a way of life for a lot of people. And while a lot of us don't agree with it and a lot of us see the damage that it can cause, we didn't want to reopen that old wound, if you would. If you go to the next page, on the bottom, it's 8 of 87. It kind of goes through the executive summary here. To conserve and manage the Minnesota's aquatic resource, if you look at the second paragraph, associated fish communities, for the intrinsic values of long-term ecological, commercial and recreational benefits to the people of Minnesota. These large pike and these systems have an intrinsic values not only to any one group, but just the way that they do affect the resource at large. I'm trying to get through this quickly because I know that we have lots of other people here. If you look at page 17 of 87, it talks about how the overharvest of medium to large northern pike is very detrimental to the size structure of northern pike. What ends up happening is that when you kill the large spawning females, is that then the younger fish are forced to reproduce at a younger age. So instead of those fish putting on weight as they grow and getting larger, they're using that energy to create eggs and therefore creating a stunting effect of the fish. And one of the last pages on here, it speaks towards basically how when you get this stunting effect with the northern pike, just how much it ravages the aquatic ecosystem as a whole. These fish really retard the recruitment of not only muskies, but walleyes, yellow perch, and pretty much anything. I don't know how many people here do a lot of fishing, but if you've ever fished on a hammer handle lake before, where it's just small northern pike, it's very hard for any young of the year fish to get through that gauntlet of predators. And that's one of the things that we're very concerned about. It's not only spearing of muskies, but it's also how are these fish going to be reproducing. Cass Lake is a very, very unique lake in our state. Cass Lake does not get stocked with any fish at all. Contrary to the testimony you've heard from Mr. Spreck, Cass Lake has never been stocked with muskies, to my knowledge or any biologist's knowledge that I know of. Cass Lake is a purely natural fishery, and that is very, very unique in Minnesota. In fact, I believe it's one of the only, if not the only, muskie lake that has a purely natural lake that has a spearing ban on it. And in turn, Cass Lake is the best naturally occurring muskie lake in this state for muskies, period, end of story. Some of the other people gave some testimony as far as there should be all these big fish coming out of there. Well, what he didn't tell you is that the 16th biggest fish in muskie zinc last year came from Cass Lake. And the top 10, I want to say, all came from Ontario or Quebec. So that's saying something right there. And to get a little more into the just what we're afraid of is going to happen with the biology of this.
Hold on, Mr. Kellett.
Yeah. Mr. Kellett, for a non-fisherman, you said that says something. What is it saying? Your last statement.
The 16th largest fish came out of that lake. That's an attribute to how good that muskie lake really is. And there's a lot of lakes out there right now that kick out a lot of very big fish, and especially out east and up in Ontario. You know, some of these lakes, they might see 1,000 muskie fishermen, you know, a year in total, whereas in Minnesota it's getting a lot more pressure. And it's a lot more exploited resource in Minnesota than a lot of these far-off Canadian destinations.
Mr. Kellett, muskie spearing is illegal.
Correct.
So I think it's helpful for the committee to narrow down, now that you've kind of given the general overview, narrow down what this is all about. This is a... Because it's already illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere?
It is illegal everywhere to spear a muskie. Mm-hmm. In Minnesota. I don't know about other states. So here's the dilemma we're facing. Given that it is illegal, why are muskie anglers still concerned?
Thank you, Mr. Senator. There has been a noted... it is illegal, but as far as that topic's concerned, it's next to impossible to catch someone if they do accidentally or intentionally spear a muskie unless they keep that fish. If a fish gets speared, those people are not going to be taking that fish home for fear of being cited in violation of that. Those fish will end up going back down the hole, whether they're alive or if they're still alive, they'll swim off they'll die somewhere else. If they're dead in the hole, they will just move the ice shack. Some of my other friends who are here tonight to testify have have documents of fish that we have found in that regards.
So your group feels that there's a significant amount of attrition in the muskie population.
Yes.
Because of spearing, because it's rather unenforceable, not totally unenforceable, but fairly unenforceable.
Correct.
And since Cass Lake is not stocked, as you indicated, and we'll get more into that with the DNR, you feel that the numbers of reproducing muskie will steadily decline?
That is a very distinct possibility.
All right. Is that the rub here?
That's half the rub.
Stock casts. We accidentally spear a number, and that the reproduction will steadily go down.
That is half of it right there. The other, the DNR will speak to what they will and won't stock and the reasons why it's not stocked. The other problem is that if these lakes do turn to hammer handle lakes, if you look at page 2 on down of the second handout, is that it shows the population dynamics of the pike in this system. These lakes that are speared, the average size of these pike are very, very small. So, I mean, we've already kind of can look into the crystal ball and see what's going to happen with this lake's pike population if this does go through, unless we are able to put some sort of a slot limit or any other protection on these pike.
Senator Olson, then Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, well, Mr. Chair. I can't frame for my colleagues what a hammer handle lake is. You're talking a foreign language in some of these terms, so I'd appreciate if you would translate.
Senator Olson, a hammer handle refers to a small, skinny northern. It looks rather like a handle of a hammer more than a fish. And sometimes people call them snakes because they're just so thin. They're the small northerns that are really aggressive, and they tend to eat up a lot of the smaller fish.
Mr. Chairman, it's not referring to the lake. It's referring to a fish.
It's a return.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, most of your muskie tournaments are held, obviously, they're held in the opposite season that we're in right now, warmer weather type tournaments. What's the morbidity rate on muskies during those tournaments?
During the tournament, I'm sorry. Senator, it's unknown. There's actually studies going on right now to that effect as far as what the mortality is. And the tournaments that we have, we've actually gone to, and Minnesota's been very progressive on this, is that we don't have judge boat tournaments anymore. When a judge boat tournament was when you catch a fish, someone would come on over to verify it, then it'd be immediately released. Now, we've actually taken it a step further where you catch the fish, you measure the fish, you take a picture of the fish, and you put it right back in the water. You don't move the boat whatsoever. So it's no different than fishing on any other day. And the approximated mortality rate right now that we figure is somewhere around 2 to 4%. And that's by all anglers, not just muskie anglers. So that's Johnny Weekend guy who catches a 40-inch fish, who flops it in the bottom of his boat, lets it sit there till 2 or 3 minutes till it stops flopping, mm-hmm. unhooks it, and lets it go. So,
next question. Can you ice fish for muskie?
No, Senator. The season closes December 1st.
All right. Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Two questions. That actually brings one up to that point. So, if you catch one, I mean, obviously the fish doesn't know it's not seasoned. And that swallows a hook, of course, that muskie could die, just like anything else. One of the things the committee members just made basically a statement. I've got a muskie lake in my area that fishermen are concerned about muskies eating walleyes. Now, that's a whole different conversation. And there's a whole lot of folks that are very angry about muskies in their lake because they're eating the walleyes. Now, I don't know that the science is there, but I think the DNR can probably enlighten us on that. So,
Senator Olson, then we should go to the next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to very quickly say this is, I mean, in our area, the main fish that people come there to fish for and staying resorts for, and the fish that brings them there is walleye. And so if we were really true to wanting to be as pure as possible and maintain the original ecosystems of these lakes, we wouldn't be stocking muskies.
and that's just the way it, you know, that so it's kind of hard to say you're going to be pure in one sense and not in another. There are a lot of fishermen, as Senator Ingebrigtsen said, my husband included, that are very unhappy about what used to be good walleye fishing lakes that are where the walleye population has really gone down because of the muskies. And in terms of the size of the northerns, again, I'm no expert, but I know that the muskies and northerns are fairly similar. And if you're stocking the muskies in those lakes, you can assume that they're going to be competing with the northerns, which could certainly explain why you have smaller northerns in that those lakes where you're stocking. And that could seems to me like just as rational an explanation or a more rational explanation because the muskies are eating them.
Okay. Mr. Dean Peterson?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Kellett. And maybe Kevin Cochran could come to the table as well. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman, committee. I also go to Cass Lake. I go every year. I spend money in Cass Lake. I spend money in the Earth Bait Shop. But I think the spearing ban should stay on. I'm against removing it. I go back to Ron Scherer. Ron Scherer, as many of you know, has been a longtime writer for the Minneapolis Tribune on hunting and fishing issues. He's written several books, TV program. He's retired now, but before he retired, he wrote some articles right before he retired about different issues. And I cut one of those articles out of the newspaper. I'm not going to bore your time and read it to you, but there's about half a dozen paragraphs I'd like to read to you at this time. Anglers need to protect big pike before there aren't any left. There's plenty of pike around, but they are all hammer handles, 20 inches or less. The 40-inchers are becoming very rare and will disappear altogether if something isn't done about to preserve them. Consider one of Minnesota's most pressing fishing problems, the rare status of a 10-pound-plus northern pike and the almost statewide abundance of stunted northern pike, those under 20 inches long, called hammer handles. DNR fish biologists contend the cause of stunning pike is the other lack of large pike, roughly 30 inches or more. Time after time, the DNR has been stopped from imposing special trophy pike regulations. We have to understand that big pike are like a rare fish. There's not one trophy pike lake in Canada that I know of that allows the killing of any 40-inch fish. Choice. We can take a few bold steps in the name of restoring pike trophy fishing, or we can keep rocking the pike boat and going nowhere. Things are a lot different nowadays. The baby boomers are retiring. There's more fishing pressure now. I guess I'm looking at this at a statewide issue. Right now, as far as the spearing people, do they have a right to spear in Minnesota? You bet they do. Right now, they're in spearing in 90% of the lakes in Minnesota. There are very few lakes where they can't spear. I believe the problem is a big pike. If people can't catch them here, where are they going to go? They're going to go to Canada. I think one other thing I'd like to touch on, you mentioned about walleyes, musk-eating walleyes. Most extensive research was done by the University of Wisconsin. They did in the early 1990s what muskie ate. What they did is they actually caught these fish by nets. Shocking. Caught over 1,000 fish, and they physically pumped the stomachs of these fish out. They took the contents of these fish. And they broke it down percentage-wise, what these muskie ate. They did this over a 3-year period. They did this in 34 lakes. They did it in all seasons. Spring, they did it in summer, fall. Far and away, have you been able to hear me?
Yes.
By far and away, the largest percentage of what they ate was sucker-type fish. Buffaloes, carp, things like that. What do these fish do? They uproot vegetation. They're bottom feeders. When other fish have, their eggs go to the bottom. Of the 100% of the contents, 3.4% of what the contents was walleye. So 96.6% something other than walleye. And suckerfish was just about triple of anything else. So what this is done by the University of Wisconsin. If anybody wants a copy of this, I'll get you a copy. So just give me your name and address. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Cochran.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mr. Cochran. Sorry. My name is Kevin Cochran, Mr. Cochran. I'm also a kindergarten teacher, so maybe why I refer to myself as Mr. sometimes. Cass Lake, I'm a Cass Lake Chamber of Commerce member, Cass Lake Muskie Inc. member. I teach kindergarten in Cass Lake, and I'm very concerned about what the lift of this ban could do. There's a lot of talk referring to stock lakes and comparing them to Cass Lake itself. The stock lakes, they get stocked with muskies. Cass Lake is 100% natural lake. It does not get stocked with any muskies. The stock lakes, it has been documented that the stock lakes, the muskie lakes, there are spearing of muskies going on. And I'm also a muskie guide in the summer, and I fish 100 to 120 days in the summer. And we do catch muskies that have been speared by dark house anglers, and we do have pictures of those here. I want to talk a little bit about what spearing can do to one lake in particular, and that's Lake Bemidji. This was a creel survey conducted in 90 and 91, and it estimated the winter spearing for the angling hours spent at 4% out of a total of 127,000 hours. And the northern pike population, that 4% of hours spent spearing accounted for 24% of all the northern pike taken that whole entire year. And the average pike in 1990-91 was 4.80 pounds. The average pike 10 years later was 1.93 pounds. And the angling hours spent spearing was a little bit larger. It was 6%. They accounted for 51% of all the northern pike harvested throughout the whole entire year. And spearing is only over a 2.5 month period. We're talking about a 12 month time span here. Now, Bemidji is an excellent muskie lake as well, but it's a stocked fishery. And these fish cannot be compared to the Cass Lake fish. The Cass Lake does not get stocked. They rely solely on natural reproduction. The Cass Lake ban evaluation that was completed 10 years ago noted that the size of the muskie and the pike increased. And my catch rates and sizes will indicate that as well. And the evaluation also suggests that muskies were getting speared, whether it was intentionally or unintentionally. And the ban is working right now, and the DNR wants to continue to carry this ban over so it can continue to work.
Thank you. We got to keep moving, okay. Senator Olson. Rob Kim and Troy Zulski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I just, while they're coming up, make one quick comment? Mm-hmm. In my experience, when most people are fishing, angling, they're fishing walleye. We catch northerns all the time. We throw them back because people are fishing to eat walleye. So I just wanted to make that comment. I think that's why you see the statistics that you do.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, my name is Rob Kim, and I am grateful for the committee's time, and I will keep my comments brief out of respect for your time. I know you're busy, and this is a long agenda. It seems like as we've gone through this discussion about this bill, the waters get muddier and muddier. We started out talking about the economic impact on Cass Lake, and pretty soon we're off in the weeds talking about muskies eating walleyes and the average size of pike and what a hammer handle is. I want to get back to my opposition to this measure and the reasons for it, because this is something that I feel very strongly that this committee should oppose. The economic argument for Cass Lake is understandable, but there is also, I think, gone unacknowledged, other than a few mentions by Sean Kellett, a significant economic impact that is realized by a strong and healthy and productive natural muskie fishery on Cass Lake. Cass Lake, as has been mentioned already, is a unique fishery in the state of Minnesota. There is no example for it but the thing itself. It is one of Minnesota's and really one of the country's premier trophy muskie waters. And despite what has been said by some of the Dark Elves Association people, it has never been stocked. It is a natural muskie fishery, and as such, is only one of 44 in the state. And that's an extraordinary vulnerable resource and an extraordinary valuable one to the state of Minnesota. The Dark Elves Association, I think, will argue as well that this is an issue of access, that by denying the ability to spear on Cass Lake, they are being denied an opportunity. But there are, as has already been mentioned, hundreds of other lakes in the area where spearing is allowed. And muskie anglers are going to share their concerns about incidental spearing of muskies, which, whether it's accidental or deliberate, in either case is illegal, and it also is almost inevitable. It does happen. Even unintentionally, it occurs. And removing even a small number of mature adult muskies from a naturally reproducing, a naturally sustained fishery, that can pretty quickly have a pretty detrimental effect on that fishery. When you consider that an adult female muskie, which is the, you know, that is the genetic engine and the reproductive engine for that entire fishery. A 48-inch adult female muskie, which is prime spawning age, basically in the prime of its life. If that fish is, one individual fish is removed from the fishery, it can take 15 years, 18 years to replace that fish. That's production for sustaining that natural fishery that is simply gone. All those things having been said, my chief concern with this bill is that there's already a process in place with the state of Minnesota and with the Department of Natural Resources for addressing these very issues, and that's the Department of Natural Resources itself. We have a Division of Fisheries in the DNR that is filled with highly qualified, very professional, and very passionate individuals who take as their sole responsibility the responsible management of the state's resources, including resources like Cass Lake. Those fisheries professionals have participated with people from Muskies, Inc., from Northerns Incorporated, from the Dark Elves Association, spending many, many hours putting together a long-range management plan for pike and muskies in the state. And I think that process should be allowed to address this issue. There's the DNR has a process in place for managing our fisheries, and I am concerned that managing of individual fisheries is going to become a legislative matter, to be quite honest with you. Let the DNR do what they're best at, which is managing our fisheries in a very responsible manner. And I will end my comments and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Zilski.
Yes, thanks, you, Chairman and Committee. I'm Troy Zilski, President of Twin Cities Muskies, Inc. As you know, we do have a big roll-up in the Cass Lake Leech Walker area. We host a tournament up there that we bring up words of 600 contestants for a three-day period after post-peak, you know, vacation time after Labor Day. We do so without any economic help from the local committees. So I mean, we bring hundreds of thousands of dollars to this. And it's kind of funny is that they never did reach out and contact me about this issue. They have concern about us. Why were we never going to contact it? Again, we didn't use the resources in the system that's in place, like Rob stated. The DNR is there. They're there to help facilitate change and bring this back. So to me, the bottom line is that we sat at the round table. We're for productive slots. We're there to make the fishery better. Today's society, everything in the society is about going green, renewable resources, making things better for our future to come. Harvesting trophy pike, not putting limits on here, protecting walleye, pike, and other fisheries do nothing but hurt fisheries. It's been proven. By us going around the DNR and not using our resources in place, we're putting at harm the future of our kids' fisheries out there. We already have regulations for other sports out there, hunting. You can't use rifles in this area. I'd love to use them, but you can't. Those are the laws. That's what we must live by. Let the people that are responsible for this do their job. That's why I asked us, for this to be tabled. Let those people do their work and do their diligence. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Underhill, do you need to add anything?
If I could.
Okay. And then maybe whoever from the DNR could approach as well. Is it from someone from the DNR that's going to speak on this? Mr. Underhill.
Chairman, Senators, thank you for allowing me this time. I've got some things that are being passed out, some photos and that. And this is the reason that we are here about this issue, is the spearing of muskies on Cass. There was a degree of incidental and purposeful spearing of muskies. That's why the ban was put in place for the experimental 10 years. And this is occurring. It's happening every year. That one fish in the back, that was on Plantagenet last year. It's still going on. Things haven't changed that much.
Mr. Underhill, what's the one with the second of the...
Up on the one on top?
Second to the last page that's in the... It's in the winter.
The winter? That fish was Plantagenet last year. It was speared and released, is what they commonly call it in the bar and amongst themselves. Two anglers went in and drilled their holes. They looked down in the hole and saw this large white object down there. They snagged it, brought it up, got some pictures of it. It had been speared and kicked back into the hole. And the fish was given to the Bemidji office to be looked at, so the DNR had that fish. January.
This is a dead muskie that was snagged
dead one.
By ice fishermen.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Okay.
And we could impose greater sentences and larger fines for poachers, but the conservation officers have to knock on doors. There's no windows in a dark house. They can't see. You have to allow them in. So it's virtually impossible to catch these guys doing this. And this isn't all dark house anglers. 99% of them are like the rest of us, law-abiding and good sportsmen. But it's that 1% that can do a large amount of damage in a short period of time. This issue with Cass Lake, it's a heated issue. It always has been in the past. There was Muskies Inc. members that have had their lives threatened over this issue. Frank Schneider Jr. was attacked in a meeting. There was threats that every fish that came through the hole in Pike Bay and Kitchee and Druja were going to be speared. It's not just a pretty issue, and I don't. That's the one problem I have with it, is it does, as Sean Mellett mentioned, it breaks open a new wound and an old wound and makes it new again. This natural lake, it doesn't get stocked. It doesn't get stocked for walleyes, pike, muskie. It is doing fine the way it is. And it really should be left as such. There's over 50 game refuges and sanctuaries where I can go in and I can shoot a coyote with a .30-06, but I can't trap it. as well, I can't go out and shoot a deer with that same rifle. So there isn't straight continuity across the board with all regulations, as we know. And for the economic impact, I know Muskies Inc. members and non-Muskies Inc. members probably more so go to that area, come from Chicago, Milwaukee, all over, and spend money there. And that is possibly in the balance as well. The winter fishing, if you look at the creel surveys of Cass Lake and the netting data, all the fish are bigger than the surrounding lakes. The average size of the walleye is like 1.5 pounds. That's the things that the community should be supporting is and promoting is getting more people up there to fish that lake and go after the perch. It's got a good perch fishery. That would be what I would do to increase the revenue in the winter. Doing this, I don't see it as being a good thing. And my recommendation would be to allow the process that we've been working on for the last 4 years work. I'll send this back to the DNR to go back through the ESOSID workshop, let us work it out, give the DNR time to compile whatever information they have now, and make their recommendation to you next year.
All right, thank
That's
you.
That's all I have.
All right, thank you. We got to move on. Mr. Bogus, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. I'd like to just make a couple of quick comments and then ask Dirk Peterson, our Acting Fisheries Chief, to review just some of the facts of where we're at with this issue. Obviously, as you've heard today, this is a very kind of polarized issue among the angling community. It's one where too frequently it seems like we're dealing with trying to balance the social interests around fishing with the biological facts that we know about the fishery. We have, as you've heard earlier, done a statewide ESOSID plan. ESOSIDs are the family of northern pike and muskellunge, and that's given some sort of generalized statewide direction for managing these species. We're currently working through some more specific issues with an ESOSID work group, and we'd certainly be willing and interested in bringing this issue to that work group to come back to this committee and the legislature with some recommendations. Specifically on the letters that were referenced earlier in the testimony, I'd like to apologize that we have not responded to the mayor, to Senator Olson. Those were misdirected within the DNR, and we will be responding to those soon. And with that, I'd like to ask Mr. Peterson to quickly just walk through a little bit of the history of the regulation and the biology around this issue from the DNR's perspective.
I don't know if we want to get into that. Maybe we could take some specific questions that have kind of been raised in the testimony. Would that be all right, Mr. Peterson?
I think there.
Could we just give us a paragraph intro? But I don't think we have time for.
If I could have.
We've heard a lot, and I think we understand that it is a. There are complexities to it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dirk Peterson. I'm the acting fisheries chief, and if I may take just a few minutes to briefly peruse the information
just
that I've provided.
Just take a couple minutes, because we've got a long bill after this as well.
Yes. Okay, committee members, I have some information that capsulizes the process that went through the Cass Lake spearing ban and the evaluation of that.
Is that the evaluation of Cass Lake spearing ban?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And basically, as you're aware, this was a classic collision between northern pike spearing interests and muskie interests back then. At the time, the proposal to do a spearing ban was proposed and adopted, 10-year evaluation. During that 10-year evaluation, the field office tried to collect as much information as they could from as many different angles as they could, because muskies are low density and difficult to sample. So they wanted to try as many avenues as they could to get a handle on if the muskie population was changing during the evaluation period. At the close of the period, they concluded with several strings of data that the muskie population had improved. Northern pike had remained pretty stable. And that was the test for the rule, was to see if there was improvement or enhancement in the muskie population. At the end of the 10-year period, there was a public input meeting to determine if the ban should continue. And it was a pretty divided vote with a slight majority to those in favor of continuing the ban. And the DNR made the assessment to continue with the ban and move to special regulation, which essentially made it permanent, but it can be changed. But the second page, I would show you a couple of graphics here. We've got additional information since 1998. And the top graphic is just showing Cass Lake and the connected waters that are named. The next graphic highlights the change in the muskie population from the beginning of the ban to the present. This is angler information showing in blue bars the average size of muskie has improved in angler caught fish from our surveys. The red line shows the percent that are greater than 40 inches, the green line those that are greater than 48, and the purple line those that are greater than 50. So from our extended evaluation, we would conclude that the spearing ban contributed to the improvement in the walleye or the muskie population. We wouldn't say that it was the only factor. The graphic below that is also from our Cass Lake Creel through a little shorter time frame, but the boxes, the dark boxes, indicate the increase in fishing pressure for northern pike. The diamonds show the increase in fishing pressure for muskie over this time frame. And the interesting feature here, of course, is that the northern pike population in the X's has remained relatively stable, maybe slightly increasing. So our conclusion is that the spearing ban has been partially responsible for the improvement in muskie, a fourfold increase in northern pike angling, and a twofold increase in muskie fishing have allowed the muskie or the walleye, the northern pike population to remain stable, and muskies have improved. I can take any questions from there.
Talk to me about the stocking on Cass. Why wouldn't the DNR want to stock muskies on Cass? Wouldn't that solve the whole problem here?
Well, first of all, a healthier system is one, or Mr. Chairman, a healthier system is one that naturally reproduces fish, and it's probably a higher standard to manage the fishery that way. To provide additional angling opportunity, we do stock some lakes where natural reproduction will not be likely, and we do that with walleye in other situations. But to manage a natural population for its angling opportunity is an important thing. The other aspect is that, you know, you're trying to manage for those trophies. There's just going to be a few in the lake at that higher density. Increasing stocking is probably not going to be that helpful in a naturally reproducing system. So.
But here's why I asked. Your study just showed that there was a partial improvement on the muskie population by removing the social factor of spearing.
Mm-hmm.
So to reintroduce a social factor of spearing could be compensated with another social factor of stocking. What would be the problem there?
Well, I think you'd be, Mr. Chairman, with stocking and a higher density of muskies in the lake, you would probably increase the potential for incidence of accidental or intentional spearing if you assume that that social factor had some influence on the overall abundance and size of muskies in the first place.
Well, isn't that the conclusion we've reached? If when we take away spearing, which is illegal, and that is a partial reason for the population improving, haven't you just made the statement that there is attrition going on with spearing, accidental or illegal spearing going on? Haven't you just confirmed that with that study?
We believe that, Mr. Chairman, we believe that spearing may contribute to this improvement in muskie populations on this lake, yes.
So if we have other lakes with spearing that
still have good muskie fishing in the summer, and they have stocking, why not examine stocking on Cass Lake to address this social problem we're grappling with? We cannot. I apologize. Mr. Peterson.
Well, I guess I'm of the opinion that we are better managing natural populations. Stocking provides, in a smaller lake, where people have an opportunity to catch those fish. And I think Senator Olson highlighted that you probably have a better chance of catching those fish in those lakes. But we do try and manage for natural communities to put the muskie in balance with the walleye as well as the northern pike. And I think there's a community aspect that can be beneficial as well.
Okay. I agree that it's better, but we have an issue here.
Yes.
And fishing is a social issue. It's not a biological endeavor.
Yes.
Senator Olson, then Keelock.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, this may not be germane to your decision, I would just like to say that it's been very disappointing that both the mayor of a community and a senator could ask the DNR specifically in a written letter and an email letter coming from different sources, and then knowing an introduced a bill has been introduced, and get absolutely no response until 30 seconds before I came into this meeting today. And none of the people have had a chance to see this information from the DNR who came here, because it wasn't given in response to these letters. We haven't had these reports. We haven't had this information, which apparently, you know, the Muskie's people have had.
Okay.
And I would also just like to say that from either direction, but specifically to the Muskie people, that the threatening kinds of communications that I've gotten are really not helpful.
What is, Mr. Bogus, Mr. Peterson, what is the department's position on this bill?
Mr. Chair, it's a DNR rule that we've put into place and that we support at this time, but we'd be certainly willing to take a harder look. We're not supportive of just making the change without some additional discussion.
Senator Olson, I'm getting notes slipped to me from committee members that they would like to ponder this issue. I think it might be a good idea. You know, whether we had this information before or now, I think it'd probably be a good idea. I don't think it would serve either side of the issue to vote now anyway. And I don't know what side the committee would vote on either.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say how much I appreciate all the time that the committee's given to this issue and the fact that some of this information, I'm sorry it had to take a committee hearing to kind of bring the information forward.
So the bill is not dead. We're going to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill. And this is what we do with many of our game and fish proposals anyway. This is why I wanted the committee to spend some time on this. Number one, when you sign up for the Natural Resources Committee, you sign up to talk about fishing, in part. Number two, this is a social issue. And I think that's important for us as we consider these types of proposals to understand is that there's lots of biology involved, but this is a social management issue as much as it is a game and fish management issue. And I think we can see that with the two passionate sides of this debate. And thirdly, this committee has oversight over Minnesota's natural resources and its environment. And so it is always appropriate for this committee to review legislation or proposals or have hearings on issues affecting game and fish or any environment issue. This issue comes up quite a bit that we should just let the DNR and the experts do the work, and that is appropriate, but we have oversight, and as elected officials, we have that ultimate authority to make the law. But if we're going to do that, we're going to get into it in detail and understand the issues before we wade into them and make a decision. So, with that, Senate file. Oh, excuse me, Senator Kielash, you had a comment. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm not I haven't been a long-time member of the committee, but I don't know that. I look at this bill as a little bit of micromanaging the DNR and their fishery studies. I don't know if they've put it into all the studies that they could have done or responded as well as they could have done, but that's another issue. I'm just not sure of the history of the committee that is it our policy to oversee what all the DNR decisions are, and have we done a lot of that in the past?
Zach Kielash, yes, it is. Yeah, it is. We've done that many times. Senator Stephen.
Mr. Chair, just to respond to Senator Kielash's point, I think that it's also that Senator Olson made a good point that as a member who represents an area that's doing its best to manage its natural resources to bring in more economic development to help the businesses in the local area, that it is inconceivable that the DNR would not respond to her inquiry or to the mayor's inquiry about this very subject. So to say that she is going about micromanaging this issue is not appropriate, because she's just trying to get the state agency to respond to her local constituents' concerns.
It was a question by Senator Kielash whether we were, and that's appropriate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I have nothing against the bill, or I'm just trying to find out if this kind of legislation is something that we typically do with the studies that the DNR. I don't see that as happening very often, especially when you're talking about a specific lake and a specific change in that lake for economic reasons.
In the end, there are 1.2 million anglers in Minnesota, and we all have them as our constituents, and it's important that they have a voice at the Capitol.
Thank you, members.
Senate File 2484 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Gaming Fish Bill. Thank you all, and thank you to the all the witnesses. Senator Saxhog, if members don't mind, we'll just have all the witnesses speak to both Senator Saxhog and my bill. Okay. Thank you, Senator Saxhog, for your patience. Senate File 2691.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting, as you said, Senate File 2691. This bill will repeal Chapter 84.02 relating to definitions. The purpose of this bill is to remove any definitions concerning the Outdoor Heritage Amendment from Section 84 with the intention of anything being put into further definitions would be put into Chapter 97, which relates to Game and Fish Statute and the Outdoor Heritage Amendment. Last year, when the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council began the process of determining projects to use the dedicated funding dollars, I felt it was necessary to create further definitions for the words protect, enhance, and restore. After that, the other body felt it was necessary to create different definitions. The constitutional amendment is, as I read it in of House File 2285 in 1.28, says 33% of the receipts shall be deposited in the Outdoor Heritage Fund and may be spent to restore, protect, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And I consider that to be pretty clear. My bill would remove any reference to the definitions from 84 and go back to basically what was passed by the voters of the state of Minnesota. I'd like Mr. Knopf, Mr. Chair, to briefly describe the sections we are repealing, and then I'd stand for any questions.
Mr. Knopf, to that point, Mr. Chair, members, actually you can see if you look at the bill, you'll see this not only deletes the or repeals the definitions that were enacted last year, the ones with regard to restore, protect, and enhance, but it also repeals the definitions with regard to native prairie, since these were definitions that were put in statute in 2007, and they really are not used anymore. It has a 25-mile radius, those sorts of things. So this basically repeals all of 84.02, including the restored prairie provisions and the provisions regarding the definitions for the constitutional language, and then it also repeals this application in 3.3006 that says that those definitions of enhance, protect, and restore apply to all funds appropriated and purposes authorized under the Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund, and Outdoor Heritage Fund. So this would repeal all of that, and so these definitions would not be in statute anymore. You can see, if you look at the appendix, you can see all the provisions that are being repealed.
Senator Chaudhry, did you want to weigh in on that?
Mr. Chair, the reason why I joined Senator Saxhog is because our bills are nearly identical, and many of the witnesses are going to speak to the identical parts of our bill. And then the portion of my bill that is different is that I also repeal the quote-unquote legislative guide that was part of the conference committee report last year from the legacy amendment. The Senate had not considered that, there was considerable consternation about the legislative guide, particularly since then. Maybe Mr. Knopf can talk about that as well.
Mr. Knopf, we're referencing Senate File 2830 at this time.
Well, Mr. Chair, could I respond to
Senator Saxon?
Yeah, I just so we make it very clear that my bill does not delete the guide that is currently being put together over in the House. I, from what I understand, it isn't anywhere close to being part of what's going on. And at this particular point, I hear that it doesn't even, in fact, define protect, enhance, and restore. So those are just hearsay, but I do want to make it quite clear that my bill does not do that. But I agree with Senator Chaudhry that we, in the essence of time, we really need to take this testimony together, just so people giving testimony are clear about that.
Mr. Knopf, to Senate File 2830, then.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. If you look at Senate File 2830, and if you look at the very back page, it's called 3R. It's in the appendix. You'll see the language, the additional language that's being repealed in Senator Chaudhry's bill, as opposed to this is not a part of Senator Saxhog's bill, but the additional language in the legislative guide being repealed. And if you look on 3R, you can look at see the language for yourself on basically these committees putting together a guide to recommend to the legislature for people looking for money from the various funds.
Members, we're going to bring people to the witness stand then that may be addressing both bills. Senator Chaudhry?
And just briefly, Mr. Chair, my view on the native prairie definitions, this committee dealt with this issue extensively last year, and unfortunately we were not able to get even a compromise language accepted by the House in our Environment Policy Conference Committee, so we're bringing back the repeal. As Senator Saxhog said, that standard is not even really being used. Regarding the definitions of restore, protect, and enhance, this is an issue where I think it does go too far in trying to micromanage the details of conservation practice. And the reason why I can say that in this case is because we can't find any conservation practitioners who support it. Certainly not the vast majority of the conservation practitioners. In the previous bill, we had a legitimate division of opinion. In this case of the definitions of restore, protect, and enhance, there are none, and we have yet to understand where the definitions came from, how they were established, and certainly what practitioners or scientists even support them. And we had extensive testimony in the conference committee from the DNR on this type of practice, and the department was at that time, and I don't know what their position is now, we'll hear from them, was vociferous that this type of definitions would be damaging to the and are wrong. and they're just plain wrong. We don't manage all of our lands for ecological value only. We manage for lots of different reasons, for recreation, for habitat, which is a subset of ecological value. And we always strive for the highest quality use, which is ecological value, but to mandate that is incorrect conservation policy. And that was emphasized time and time again by stakeholders, by departments, and we're going to hear from them today.
Senator Chaudhry, I'd like to ask Isis Stark to come to the witness table.
And then on the legislative guide, and then I'll be done. I'm not shy to say that this is really rather bizarre piece of statute. It requires the legislature to pass something other than a bill. And so I just, first of all, I don't know why, I don't understand that at all. I've asked around, I've asked our institutional memory when this has ever been done. I can't get an answer on that. Secondly, the stakeholders have written, multiple stakeholders have signed letters in opposition to the process that was established by the House. Again, this was a House proposal, not coming from the Senate. There are inserts in some of their drafts about creating jobs. It just doesn't make sense, and it ought to be repealed, particularly with all of the other planning that has been mandated with regards to the legacy amendment. And to somehow say that a group of legislators, in an unofficial way, off the record, is going to bind future legislatures on how to spend the money, it does not make sense, particularly when we have a perfectly good constitutional provision that we just passed by the voters to guide us. Those are my feelings on my bill.
Senator Chaudhry and Senator Saxog.
Just one quick note. I mean, I agree with what the senator said, but it is record that the first set of definitions that came out were done by the council, not by the other body. So let's remember who kind of started the whole brouhaha. My deal is to delete them all, you know, start over again or don't go without them.
And with that, Ms. Stark, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Senator Scogin, members of the committee, my name is Isis Stark. I'm a government relations director for the Nature Conservancy. I just wanted to talk about the bill. We actually support repealing some of the bill, subsections 4A, 6A, and 6B. We don't think that it's necessary to repeal all the bill or all of the statute. We think that over the last couple years since they've been in place, it hasn't been a problem for the conservation community. So just the subsections 4A, 6A, and 6B is what we'd like to see repealed.
Questions for Ms. Stark? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a question. I think I'll just make a comment. Thank you for the testimony, Ms. Stark. We have had, obviously, a lot of debate in this committee about subdivisions 2 and 7 that relate to 25-mile boundaries, et cetera, on native ecotypes. And I think pretty much everyone in this legislature, almost, at least in the Senate side, we've had a compromise. We came to a compromise. We came to language that Bowser was very supportive of in the last couple of years, and we put that language in all of our spending bills. So it currently guides appropriations and it guides spending, and I think it should. I'd like to put it in statute eventually, but maybe we can't do that right now. It's too contentious. I mean, if we could put that in here, I'd be all for that. But I think we have that compromise for how to manage native prairie restorations. We have that language guiding our appropriations already, so I'm not sure that we have to have it as a definition section. So just want people to know that we've got that in place.
Questions for Ms. Stark? Thank you for your testimony. Lance Ness?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance, and speaking on behalf of that group today. Senator, members, I'll read a brief statement, then I'll just answer questions. I'll keep it short. We support the current definitions adopted by the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. We would urge your committee to analyze and look at these definitions as well. We are very concerned that the definitions of protect, enhance, and restore will be broadened and will result in expenditures from the funds that are not and were not intended. The definition should be precise and finite, with a focus like a laser beam to specific projects and goals that will result in the intended outcomes that the citizens of Minnesota voted for. We are concerned that there will be attempts to divert the funds for other purposes by broadening the definitions. We ask your committee to discuss these definitions and take into consideration the 10-year debate that went into this issue, that its primary purpose was to protect, enhance, and restore fish and wildlife habitat, land and water conservation. We urge you to hold true to the will of the people who voted for this amendment and honor their vote. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Ness? Seeing none, Bob Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Ness. Bob Meyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Natural Resources, and I'm going to be really brief. I just want to say thank you, Senator Saxog and Senator Chaudhry, for bringing this issue up. As we all recall, the end of last session, we did have a lot of concerns about the definitions that were put in place, primarily not only what the words were, but where they were being placed. Placing them in Chapter 84 had a lot of unintended consequences throughout the department, and also defining terms in Chapter 3, 3.3006 did not make a lot of sense for people looking at how they're supposed to be appropriating parks and trails dollars or clean water dollars. That chapter of law basically dictates the legislative activities. It was concerning for us to see those terms placed in there, not have a lot of openness there where those are. So we do appreciate the efforts. Look forward to working with everybody as this moves forward. I understand people have some concerns about some of the terms that are out there, but realistically, if the definitions are going to be put in place and where they should be, what the different funds are, where those funds are established in statute.
Questions for Mr. Meyer? Thank you. Just sit tight, Mr. Meyer, because I believe you're going to also speak to the next bill.
That covers for
both of them?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Others who would like to speak for or against Senate File 2691, the Saxog bill? Seeing Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. Would this be the right time to bring it up?
So we're dealing with Senate File 2691. Senator Anderson, for your amendment.
2691. I'll let it be passed out. And I don't have my copy anymore. I gave them all away.
Here, send it to Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is an amendment to, it's Senator Saxog's bill, but it could certainly apply to Senator Chaudhry's bill as well. And it relates to the definitions of protect, enhance, and restore. And Senator Saxog and I have been talking about this for a while, and I think have both agreed that it would be nice to try to find peace in the valley, and that's what this is an effort to do. And that, in that spirit, I would like to offer this amendment. We've had quite a bit of conflict between those who support the council language and those who support the House language that's now in statute. And I don't think conflict is good for any of us. I don't think it's helpful. And the fact is that we have, you know, the House members who wrote the language that's in statute are not particularly interested in changing it. And so I think it's important for us, for those who, I mean, Senator Saxog, Senator Chaudhry can bring their bill forward, go to conference committee, but I don't know, I think we're going to reach a stalemate again unless we try to find some common ground. And so that's what I'm trying to do here. What this does is it takes the whole constitutional, the phrases that you get from the constitutional language directly out of the Constitution. Wetlands, prairies, forests, or habitat for fish, game, or wildlife. I guess Mr. Knopf said we should say or instead of and, so because you can't do everything in every project. So It's the same language. And then we add the concept of ecosystems, so that protecting, restoring, and enhancing is about protecting, restoring, and enhancing an ecosystem that supports or is needed to maintain wetlands, prairies, forests, habitat, fish for fish, game, and wildlife. And that's scientists for at least a couple of decades have told us that that's how it works, that you can't just take an animal out of its setting and be successful in managing it, that you have to talk about where it lives. That's what habitat really is to me. It's where it lives, and that's an ecosystem. And so what we do is add the word ecosystem and apply that to the constitutional language. And then the other change is to say that protect could go beyond acquisition of land. Those are the two things that the House, the other body, was really focused on. I think this might get us to supporting to the – I've delivered this to some House members. I don't have any commitments from anybody. But I've tried to share this with as many committee members today as I could. Several of them have seen this. Senator Saxhog and I ran this by Mike Kilgore briefly and let him see this last week. And I think it's I think it achieves the goals that everybody seems to have in agreement, the common ground that we do have. And so I'd like to offer it in that context. Last thing I want to mention is, when we have a definition in law, the council is free to interpret it more narrowly. They don't have to do – they can't go beyond what the law says, but they can go – they can interpret it more narrowly. That's – their job is to interpret the law as they see fit and deliver recommendations to the legislature. And if the legislature supports those, it doesn't mean they would have to approve projects that protect – that go beyond acquisition. It would just mean that they could if they wanted to. And so it doesn't mandate it. It just says, here's a definition that we can hopefully all agree on that's based on the constitutional intent, the constitutional language.
Okay. And thank you for that, Senator Anderson. I have no problem any way you want to do it. I want to make sure that the witnesses have a chance to testify. How should we proceed given that?
Well, and Mr. Chair, you're right, because most people haven't seen this, so I'd be happy to get reactions, whatever you want to do.
All right. Could we, while some of our witnesses approach the table, I'll take a couple comments, and then if you really want to vote today, we can do that. I don't know if we're going to get to voting on either bill today.
It's fine.
I think we should get our testimony in, because there's going to be debate.
Mm-hmm.
What did Lance Ness already testify? Mm-hmm. Gary Leaf, Mr. Shad can start approaching, and then Senator Dill, and then Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson, the way I read lines 1.7 to 1.9 is that in order to protect, you have to buy a conservation easement, or you have to acquire fee title.
Mr.
That's the way I read it. And then you can do some other things beyond that if you want to, but you have to buy.
Well,
so
Mr. Chair.
To me, it you can protect through regulation and other ways other than actually buying it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
It just says that include, but not limited to. It doesn't say you have to buy them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill. The Lessard-Sams Council definition only allows protection to be done through acquisition of fee title or easement. This would say it could include but not be limited to acquisition or fee title. So the intention is to say that it could include other measures beyond acquisition. Right now, their definition says it's limited to acquisition. And I think that's what I wanted to make that a little broader to make it possible for it to go beyond that.
Is Mr.
So
Leaf
I think
here?
We're agreeing.
Is Mr. Leaf here? Come on up. Mr. Meyer, did you already speak to this?
But it says that.
Mr. Shad, are you going to talk on this?
Not included, but are not limited
Mr. Leaf.
To.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Leaf with Sportsman for Change, and I thank you for the opportunity about discussing this issue regarding the definitions. As you know, this committee was critical in the passage of us establishing the citizen-led Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, which ultimately was a factor in certainly getting hunter, angler, and I would say conservation support for the legacy amendment, which passed in 2008. I have a handout that I gave that compares and contrasts a couple of the constitutional amendments that we passed to kind of show the emphasis that was done. You know, as you know, that in 98, Senators Lasard and Dallas Sams moved for the Constitutional Hunting and Fishing Heritage Amendment, which was passed by 77% of the voters. You also see the language pertaining to the LCCMR funds. And then you also see the language comparing the regarding the Outdoor Heritage Fund in its extent. And then the differences at the bottom in the table between the Lasard-Sams Council definitions and when they were passed, which were in January, long before March. Our view is that there could have been a lot of definitions. Every senator here could have came up with the definitions. If we go the ecosystem route, there's other definitions even in the Star and Tribune of what those things were. Our position is a compromise position between a lot of folks coming up with a variety of definitions. And the definitions that the Lasard Council passed, which two members of this committee serve on, Senator Engelbretson and Senator Anderson, that they passed in January. It's now March. This language came in at the last minute. And we support the original Lasard Council definitions. We also think that they were being hastily put in. They had unintended consequences on the DNR. They won't fit necessarily for the Clean Water Fund. They probably won't fit for the Clean Water Legacy Fund. The Senate passed the Lasard Council recommendations 67-0. I think that's pretty much unprecedented. They need these definitions as they are. And we strongly support, the bills, and in this case, probably potentially Senator Chaudhry's bill that repeals these definitions.
Mr. Shad.
For the record, Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife Director for Department of Natural Resources. Senator Chaudhry earlier mentioned that the department provided some testimony last spring at conference committee regarding these definitions, and a lot of our concern at that time was related to the definitions for enhance, which includes a requirement to increase ecological value, and the definition of restore with a requirement to achieve high-quality ecosystems. And we testified at that time that we thought that these definitions were really too narrow, really limited some of the values and purposes for which we do restoration and enhancement work. And the many of the very effective conservation programs that we've got in place right now. The reality is that the practitioners out there, the folks that are doing conservation on the land, work very closely with the ecological community. We do our habitat work, we do our restoration and enhancement work in an ecological context. And we do it in a way that addresses ecological principles and biodiversity needs. I think some good examples are the prairie restoration work that we do on a lot of our wildlife management areas, which are public hunting lands. Obviously, we're doing this for purposes for waterfowl production, pheasant production, that sort of thing. But we also do it with a variety of species. We use local seed types. We consider genetics and that sort of thing. The clear cuts that we do for rough grouse management are done to mimic natural disturbance patterns by leaving residuals, clumps of unharvested trees as legacy patches for travel routes and so forth. A lot of the grassland and forest and shoreland plantings that we do use native seeds and increasingly consider genetics considerations. We have tremendous expertise in our organizations and our agencies to do this work. I think we're fully capable of using the best science out there to do our restoration and enhancement work consistent with these ecological principles without these definitions that might limit our ability to collaborate and really pit interests against each other. These terms have been debated for years in the ecological literature, and our staff have taken a long look at the evolution of these definitions. The definitions that are now in statute are not supported by the current thinking out there in the ecological literature. They're also not consistent with how we view the terms restore and enhance as we deliver conservation programs out on the land. The definitions that the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council developed are actually closer to what practitioners would use for restore and enhance. The definitions presented here by Senator Anderson in her amendment, I think, are much more workable. We'd need to take a closer look, certainly, and talk to some additional folks. But just on the surface, I would say they're certainly more workable, more realistic than those that are in existing statute.
Thank you. Ms. Mueller and Mr. Clavin, you could both approach.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, can I just make a suggestion? I think Senator Dills pointed out some language that's a little ambiguous, and so Mr. Knopf suggests on line 8 on my amendment, after the word that, to insert may. So it says, through measures that may include but are not limited to the acquisition of fee title or conservation easements. Would that help, Senator Dill?
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, that's a step in the right direction.
So I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, from what you said, I think our goal is the same. We just have to make sure the language reflects that it should allow a little more flexibility. So,
Clavin. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, my testimony is on the bill, not the amendment.
Okay.
Would you like it on the bill?
Yeah.
All right. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Northern Seed Trade Association. Our members are up in the Valley, the Dakotas, and Manitoba. They make the seed that you use on these. In fact, we were in front of this committee last year in Senate File 692, carried by Senator Stumpf. And that bill was passed by this committee to repeal these definitions, and it was passed by the full Senate in a couple of different bills. Our issue is not the protect, enhance, and restore language. It's the 25-mile restrictions you see in Subdivision 2 and 7. And that's found on line point 18 of the Saxhog bill and 1.9 of the Chaudhry bill. And we would just urge you to adopt both of them to repeal Subdivisions 2 and 7. Thank you.
Ms. Mueller?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. I provided written testimony, which you can read at your leisure. I'm going to just briefly talk about the definitions of protect, restore, and enhance. My background is really in prairie restoration work, so I want to talk about that as well, but also very active in a number of local conservation organizations. And one of the things that I've really seen since the amendment passed for the outdoors is a real groundswell of local people working together to get buy-in on local projects that are going to make a difference in their own backyards. And I've attended a number of meetings. They were together by different groups, some sportsmen, river advocacy-type groups, other conservation-led groups, government agencies. And I think there's a real feeling that if the people can develop that local buy-in, we can accomplish an awful lot. And the definitions that were brought forward late last session seem to really be advocating for more of a top-down approach instead of a grassroots approach. So I just urge you to consider the it's being discussed. I also wanted to visit just very briefly again about the restoration definitions. It's true that these definitions are out there and they're not being utilized in the form that's in this bill right now. It's causing, I think, a little more anxiety out there than has been testified to earlier amongst the practitioners, in spite of the fact that the language in the funding bills right now don't ask people to source that seed within the county in 24 miles. Many that are giving bids are being asked to bid it and talk about whether it comes from that within that definition, and then they're being asked come within the definition of the ecoregion, and then where does it come from? And it's become a very onerous process. And
These definitions that were put into place in 2007 have discussed a lot, but there's never been a real plan forward. And this is something that's really, really needed. In my written testimony, and I'm not going to go through it in a lot of details, but if you go to the third bullet, some of the questions that still haven't been answered, and this is not only for the 25 miles, but for the ecoregions, is the state prepared to spend multiple millions of dollars needed to achieve a highly diverse seed source for each county or ecotype region? Right now we have a very highly diverse Minnesota ecosystem seed, but not for each ecoregion. The solution to this has been, well, just go to the closest source. But the closest source really isn't the only factor in defining what is a quality seed source. And so I think what I'm really going to ask after hearing today's discussion is that the agencies be directed to have some type of a stakeholder process that brings in all of the players, not just the agencies and the very wonderful nonprofits that are advocating for this, but also the practitioners that are out in the field, so that we can come up with a definition that really will lead to the kind of quality that we want. That still hasn't been done.
Thank you. Is Mr. Johnson here? Members, this is going to sound a little screwy, but we've had so many out-of-town people today. I'm going to take Mark Johnson and then lay this over, and then we'll pick it up at our next meeting so we can take the rest of the witnesses who are in town. And then I'm going to take Mr. Padula real quick on Senator Kubley's bill because he came from Montevideo. I want him to have a comeback. Mr. Johnson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for taking me, as I don't have to drive back from Grand Rapids tomorrow. Appreciate that.
I knew you liked us, but not that much.
My name is Mark Johnson. I'm the executive director for Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and I'll be quite brief with you or for you. First of all, I'd just like to mention that on behalf of Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, we strongly support SF 2830 and also SF 2691 and their repeal of the definition language that was imposed last year. We also strongly support the original Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council definitions. Just a quick note, last Saturday we had our corporate board meeting in Wilmer. There was roughly 160, 170 delegates of our chapters from across Minnesota that met throughout the day as well as Friday night. But Saturday and Friday night, the number one issue with our delegates from across the state was this. It was repealing the definitions that were imposed last year. A huge amount of consternation over the definitions that were imposed, and we definitely would like to see them repealed. I should also mention that we would like to. I definitely would encourage this committee to pass SF 2830 and 2691 without amendment. No disrespect to the amendment, but I'd like to see it clean and voted up or down. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senate File 2691 and 2830 are laid over. Thank you, members. Senator Vickerman?
Mr. Chair, are you laying the amendment?
No.
The bill both? I missed something.
Senator Vickerman, the amendment was not moved. It was passed out. Senator Kubley wrote, and we'll just take Mr. Padula, and then we've got to adjourn. And then, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Goldman, we will take you the next time we pick up the bill. Why don't we, Senate File 2641, Mr. Padula.
Looking for change put out.
We'll go to get more into the bill detail the next time we hear it, Senator Kubley. Go ahead.
Sure.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. My name is Bob Padula. I'm a sheep producer from western Minnesota. I live in Lacaparle Township, about 12 miles northwest of Montevideo, Minnesota. I have been a sheep producer in the area there for the last 10 years. I've experienced severe problems with coyotes ever since I've moved to that farm and have taken it and made quite a few strides myself personally, financially, to go through and alleviate some of the problems. The problems seem to be getting worse and worse every year. This isn't the first time that the legislature has been asked to allow counties the ability to have bounties on coyotes. My representative, Mr. Doug Peterson, submitted a bill about 10 years ago, and his son also submitted some legislation along with Senator Kubley in the past as well. I feel that bounties on coyotes will help in a short-term manner. It's not going to be meant as a comprehensive coyote management or predation problem.
Let's give Mr. Padula our undivided attention. He's driven a long way. Go ahead.
Thank you. In the past years, I've had not only sheep attacked, but I've also lost family pets, which is emotionally hard for my children to deal with, as well as the sheep. At this point, I've gone to having to go to extreme measures to deal with the predation problems. I've erected on my place a six-wire high tensile electric fence with a strand of barbed wire 2 inches off the ground as a perimeter fence that I maintain as electrified to deter coyotes. That in itself is not enough. When I first moved onto my farm, I had a coyote attack a full-grown sheep in an enclosed pen that was 125 by 175 feet with the same electrified fencing. And I watched it after it attacked the sheep. I went outside, and it snuck out underneath a gate that could not be electrified that I have to be able to walk in and out of. So even extreme measures like that, you can't control the problems with the coyotes. I've had to go through now, and I've had to resort to double fencing, where I have had to purchase electrified plastic netting to double my fencing inside my pastures to maintain that the coyotes will stay out. That does not stop the harassment and the killing, for that matter. Now the coyotes are on the outside of the fence. They chase the sheep on the outside, yip and yap and bark, causing nervousness and wariness among the animals. And the animals now, in the middle of the night, don't know where the internal fencings are. They run into the electric netting, become entangled and are strangulated, or become entangled to the point where blood circulation is cut off in their legs, and I've had to amputate hooves. Because of the constant threat with the coyotes that we have and the nervousness, my sheep are on constant edginess. They are more stressed. They're more susceptible to diseases, infestations with internal parasites, and their rates of gain are diminished. There are a lot of coyotes in my area, and the problem is increasing for all sheep producers around the state. As we look at the previous bill, one of the things that I noted when I was coming down here was the amount of money that is made available for the Outdoor Heritage Fund through the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. I look at that, and that increases habitat for coyotes. All that does for me is increase the problem for me. This bill, as I see it, as offered, is a simple solution to aid in some of the problems that I'm facing, which will allow local units of government to be able to enact bounties to help offset some of the problems that we're facing out there. It's not a burden on the state. There are no taxpayer funds from the state level going to do this. This will be something that the counties can mandate and control themselves. I've been down this before. This is not my first rodeo. And I know that there are going to be those who are going to speak in opposition and indicate that bounties are ineffective. It offers temporary relief because those animals will have to repopulate and relocate. So they're not there if they're, you know, gone in my area. I have also heard the things that people talk about how, well, people are going to abuse the system and they're going to go through and they're going to shoot coyotes in South Dakota and bring them over to Minnesota. We have pocket gopher bounties right now in the state of Minnesota. I don't see rogues of kids in bicycles from South Dakota pedaling over to Madison to go and collect a pocket gopher bounty. I don't see rogues of kids on bicycles with hose and pocket gopher traps terrorizing my local township roads. The fact that we have some people who are going to go through and do illegal activities is not a reason why this should not be supported. It's illegal to spear a fish. We heard that already, certain ones. I won't bring up anything about spearing coyotes. We don't do that in Lockwood Parlay.
Please.
Yet. But no.
Sounds like a new sport.
So anyways, and my point on this is we're suffering quite a bit. We're seeing that we are increasing our habitat for wildlife. The problem is when we do that, we start to have unintended consequences here. A bounty is something that local townships are already and counties are already set up to be able to handle and administer. If there's an abuse of power or something like that, they'll run out of the funds. They'll stop it from happening. They're in a lot better position. It's a low-cost option. I was thinking on the way in, because it's a pretty long drive, if five counties offered $2,000 apiece, that's $10,000. The potential there is to have hundreds of sportsmen out there going after coyotes in my area. If I had to depend upon the Department of Natural Resources for this, they would require at least one person, an FTE, on that. That would be a salary of probably $60,000 when you look at benefits, plus another $40,000 at least in supplemental support costs for a program, which would have one person statewide who works 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. I would much rather take my odds with 100 sportsmen out there to help me reduce my problems at a lot cheaper cost.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and the Cattlemen's Association are all supporting this bill.
And we'll take the rest of the testimony on your bill the next time we hear it, either next hearing or the hearing after.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for everyone's patience. Meeting's adjourned.